Okay, Marvin, we're talking about Francis Schaeffer and thinking about the man as well as his ideas. And his ideas, of course, are quite well preserved in most of his writings. But one of the things that we don't get so much is the heart of the person. That comes out of people or from people who had a relationship, who knew him personally. And so you are a great resource for this. And I'd like for you to begin by telling us when and how you were introduced to Schaeffer or his works, and whether or not you were a Christian at the time.
Well, thanks. Two people pushed me initially toward Francis Schaeffer. One was my wife, who had been a student at Covenant College when Schaeffer had come. This was back in the days when he was in St. Louis, had come and made a presentation or led a study, and she told me about this man who was a missionary in Switzerland and how wonderful he was. And my reaction was, Dean, I'm not the least bit interested in some missionary to the sea slopes. She had enjoyed over the years in his presence with witnesses repeating that several times. So it always got a big laugh from the people. But Gene ran across Schaeffer well before I did. The second person was a professor at David Lipscomb, now David Lipscomb University in Nashville. His name was Dr. Harvey Floyd, and he was quite taken by Schaeffer's writings. And one day after class, Harvey asked me, said, Marvin, do you know Francis Schaeffer? And I thought that was a silly question. And I said, well, no, I don't. But I made tracks to the bookstore and bought a copy of Escape from Reason. I picked it because it was the shortest book, not knowing, of course, it was the shortest book because it was the most compact book. And I read about three pages and thought, I have no idea what this is about. That was in the summer of 1972. I did, however, read C.S. Lewis, and then I came back to Schaeffer, and reading The God Who Is There, it was an eye-opening experience like no book I think I've ever read, other than maybe the Bible, of course, into making, I think the subtitle at that time was making Sense Out of Your World. And for the first time, I saw Christianity as a body of truth and not as something religious. Now, you asked if I was merely religious. You asked if I was a Christian. I think so, but I'm not sure. I came from what Presbyterians call a covenant home. My mother and father were believing Methodists, and there was never a time in my life that the things of the Lord didn't seem important. And that comes, I've discovered later, of course, from growing up in a Christian home. And they did that. So when was I converted? I don't know. Maybe as a small child, maybe at a Child Evangelism Fellowship Good News Club. I certainly trooped down front at the 1954 Billy Graham revival, or crusade, I guess they called it then, in Nashville, and made a public confession of faith and began reading the Bible. I read the Gospel of John at their direction any number of times in a row. Always carried a Bible with me off to college, off in the Air Force, off into being a husband, and those were things that meant a lot to me. So I think the answer to the question is, probably I was a Christian at the time, but my faith was so weak and in retrospect so distorted, not my parents' fault, but mine for drinking deeply at modern thinking about science and all sorts of things. I'd separated just a classic separation of faith and reality. So Schaeffer opened the whole world to me, and I just remember just thinking, I've never thought like this. I've never heard anybody think like this, write like this, I guess I should say.
So you had grown up in a Methodist home.
Yes, sir.
So you were familiar with the gospel, the Bible stories. So you had some introduction to Christianity.
Yes.
So,
my parents were very faithful. We had Bible reading and prayer every night. And if a friend spent the night with me, they were in there for the Bible reading and prayer time as well. It was a significant thing.
So what is it about Schaeffer's presentation that arrests your attention?
Well, I had the same reaction. I'm not trying to say I'm as profound as Oz Guinness was, but when he discovered Schaeffer, he said that he always thought that Christianity was truth, he didn't realize it was this true. And that was sort of the reaction that I had. All of a sudden, I thought about Christianity in an ordinary, if you're pardon the question, in an ordinary sort of way. And years later, when I was the founding chairman of a Christian school for the elementary grades, the teachers, of course, taught everything. And I insisted that we not have a Bible teacher, but that we collect teachers who were capable of teaching the Bible right along with math, which works very well from kindergarten through sixth grade or so. After that, you begin breaking up anyway into classes. And I wanted what I got from Schaefer was that I was to think about Christianity basically the same way I thought about everything else. And that's what I wanted to convey, the teachers to convey, that going down the hall and going to Bible class didn't make Christianity special. It made it took a step down because the really important things were English and math and science and things of that sort. So what Schaefer gave me was thinking of Christianity as something that was as true or more true than yesterday's morning papers. I began to think about it the same way. I just owe a great deal of debt to my wife for introducing me and to Harvey Floyd and my word to Francis Schaefer.
Now, did you and your wife spend time at LaBrie?
Yes, we did. We went to a LaBrie conference in 1975, I think, in Calgary, and met a young woman who had been in the Manson commune way, way back. Mm. She was not involved with any of the murders or anything of that sort. Mm-hmm. She was just a hanger-on, and we met her and decided that because of her escapades, it would probably be best if she weren't in the United States for a while. She had been to the Middleman's home in Switzerland, and Genziana it was called. And so we flew her across the ocean, and a few months later, we decided we'd go look in on her. So Gene and I showed up for Thanksgiving in 1975 at LaBrie. And if the books had been an eye-opener, meeting all these people there who all thought, and they weren't in lockstep like some sort of commune or the Kool-Aid people down in Latin America. It was enlightening. I remember sitting in the airport on the way home when we were waiting to come home and saying, Gene, these people think about Christianity the same way they think about the law of gravity. That that truth is one whole thing. And it was just so eye-opening and so gratifying. By the way, the woman was there, and she was doing quite well. Udo helped an awful lot of people.
And how long were you there at LaBrie that time?
Oh, just 11 days. Okay. I Larry Snyder assigned me to listen to the. He discovered that I'd already listened to all the basic Carroll House lectures on my own, and so he had me to listen to, of all things, Schaefer's lectures on the Westminster Confession of Faith. And of course, for Presbyterians, that is that's the Holy Grail of the Bible. And so it was an eye opener to hear Schaefer talk about the Westminster Confession of Faith. That's what I listened to there, and listened to the discussions. That was in 1975. What is that? 25, 41 years ago. I remember the events of those 11 days as clearly as yesterday.
So, can you tell me what was that like in terms of sort of the dynamic that was going on relationally in those meetings and your visit there for 11 days?
Well, I just remember one of the things that I took away from that was for me was part of LaBrie. Yes, it was Schaefer's statement about he was for honest answers for honest questions, and people never in those 11 days and never the rest of my experience, almost the rest of my experience at LaBrie, no one ever said, "Do you think that?" Or if you asked a question, you know, no one looked at you as if you'd ask an impertinent question. And so I really loved the open dialogue. And I remember one night there was a mercenary soldier who was sat way over in the back corner. Udo was leading the Saturday night discussion. And the guy slowly worked his way from the back right-hand corner of Farrell House, of the chapel, rather, all the way to sitting right in front of Udo, because this man, too, had never heard anybody talk like this. And it was something that was drawing in. And this is a hired killer, if you will. And he left abruptly the next day, and we never saw him again. He got a call to go lead a regiment in some country in revolution. So I won't use his name at all, but it was a dramatic sort of thing. But I remember talking to the people there and explaining, you've never seen George Washington either. You question whether he was there or not. So I was trying to convey to those people was that we think the same way. And that's the way the Labrie workers the only ones whose names I remember from those days were, other than Jane and Betty Carlson, were Udo and Debbie and Larry and Nancy Snyder. But they were very helpful to me, once again, in furthering this idea of reality is not divided. It's all one piece.
In light of this, reality is the one piece. So what part does prayer play in Schaefer's life?
Prayer, Schaefer was unnerving about prayer. Schaefer prayed frequently. He prayed real prayers. I remember years later being with him in various settings, he would stop in the middle of a hotel lobby or an airport concourse if there was something about prayer. He clearly believed that he was speaking truly to God. I remember one time he put his hand up in front of his face and he said, "The supernatural is right here." And to me, the parallel is when C.S. Lewis with Narnia, the children, Narnia was right where they were. And the supernatural reality is not divorced from it. It's just something that we don't see. Schaefer fervently believed in prayer, long prayers. And one of the things that did happen is sometimes the prayers were so long that the people who were working at Lee would sometimes avoid going to the Schaefer's home because they had chores to do. And prayer came first with those two people. And it was something that I learned and still try to practice, that prayer is something you are speaking directly to the God the Father Almighty, and it is a real communication, something to be cherished, something to be wondered at. And I got all that from Schaefer. I mean, prayer had been something sort of rote. I mean, we'd always have prayers before meals, but we always said exactly the same thing. Well, after that, I didn't say exactly the same thing anymore because I fit what I was saying to a conversation and felt that I was truly speaking to another person. That's God.
What place, not necessarily place, but what part does Edith play in the community at Labrie?
Well, Edith, of course, was a delight, and I heard Schaefer many times when someone would ask him what they should read. And Schaefer almost every time said, "You should get a copy of the Labrie story," because Edith's writing of the Labrie story showed their true faith, belief, and reliance upon God in very practical ways. It was Edith who made sure in the early days and for years later that the tables were set and the food was served, if not elegantly, it was served by people, by the workers there, to the people who were there. And so they demonstrated this sense of service. But Edith's contribution, one of her great contributions, was what we were just talking about a moment ago, was her weekly days of prayer. What a highlight that was. Everything came to a halt, and Edith led all the students in prayer. And it wasn't, it was just some sort of, "Oh, we're going to get together and pray." These were deep, long prayers where it was obvious that the people actually thought they were communing with God Almighty. And that was one of the things that Edith contributed, that she contributed the beauty of the table settings where the white napkins were folded and they were in napkin rings. I'd never seen napkin rings before. The interesting thing about the meals, I'm stretching a little bit from what you're talking about, is that after the meal was over, the workers left and the students were expected to clean up. So, and that demonstrated to the students that life is messy and things have to be fixed. Hmm.
I interviewed Jane Stuart Smith.
Now, what a treat.
Yes, now several years ago. And she recounted of her first visit to Labrie when she was not a Christian. And she reported that she knew as soon as she got in the house that she was in the home of a missionary, and that wasn't really what she was hoping for. But that in such
That leads back to the story I was telling about the Manson girl, young woman. She was hitchhiking across Europe on her way back home from Greece. And she was hitchhiking through Switzerland, and someone picked her up on the highway. And where she was going, she said, "I just need a place to crash." And this guy said, "Well, I know a place. They just take in lots of people." And they dropped her off. They dropped her off at Udo Middleman's front door. This woman is no more Christian than the door over there. And the first time she had any idea that these people were Christians is when they prayed before the meal. Yeah. That circles back to the issue of prayer. So this woman had the same experience that Jane did. She wasn't looking for a Christian place. She was just looking for three hots and a cot for a few days.
Yes, and that was pretty much what Jane was looking for. And she was just stressed out, not, you know, mentally, and somebody had suggested she go to LaBrie. What struck me, Marvin, was in her reporting of this, that her being so overwhelmed by how kind they were and how they just received her in without any judgment whatsoever, without any questions, just, "Oh, you're here, you're our guest," and that what a tremendous influence that had in her life and opening her up to say, "These people have something very serious to say."
They always treated people kindly. They never rebuffed people. We ended up coming back for 3.5 months and then coming back later for a year. And that was part of what it was at LaBrie. There was someone called the greeter who was at the door, it was called. That was the first person you saw. And it wasn't to make some sort of evaluation of you. It was just to see where and how you would fit in. But they treated everybody with dignity, because this pair of people, Francis and Edith Schaefer, truly and deeply believed that every human being was created in the image of God and were all creatures of great dignity. And that's whatever your condition was when you showed up, your national, your ethnicity, your race, your economic position, people were all treated the same way with great dignity. You were expected to carry your load living in the community. So that meant washing dishes, it meant digging up gardens, it meant turning over the dirt, it meant sweeping the floors, and for a lot of spoiled American 20-somethings, some of them had no idea how to vacuum the floor because their parents had always done it for them. And this was part of teaching these people that another great thing they held, of course, was a belief in the fall. But human beings, despite being fallen, were creatures of great respect, and that's why the napkins were there. You were treated as if you were really somebody because the Schaefers believed that you really were somebody.
So Schaefer could really make hold both of these ideas simultaneously without thinking they entailed a contradiction. One is, man can be very cruel. Man is a sinner, but on the other hand, there's something, as Schaefer would say, something very noble about even man as a sinner. There was still something very noble about humanity being made in the image of God.
Yeah, I don't know whether Schaefer, it was originally Schaefer, but I heard him say it many times. He said, "Man is a glorious ruin." Hmm. That is, we are broken by the fall, but we carry the imago Dei. We are created in the image of God in a way that that wonderful animals and whatnot are not. Human beings make significant choices. Somebody asked me once years later if I thought there'd be any dogs in heaven. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm sure there'll be no dogs in hell," because dogs don't make significant moral choices. The way you and I and our children and our wives make significant choices, and those ripples, Schaefer said, went on forever. So when a human being made a choice, the impact of that choice didn't stop going. My dog, as wonderfully as he is, doesn't have that influence on life.
So that would have been just maybe not fitting in perfectly with some of the more reformed view of, at least as some people would see it, of man being more so such a sinner that he could not do anything good.
Well, that's right. And Schaefer emphasized creativity, and you weren't there long before you saw the influence of that. And certainly, if you ever looked at any of the either of the two big films that he did, film series that he did, there was always a great emphasis on the wonder of creativity, and he celebrated it. And in his first one, How Should We Then Live, there were 30-minute episodes about all sorts of things, and they were just dramatic. The scenes from Europe and the scenes from the United States about creativity of human beings, whether they were Christians or not, you could celebrate their creativity, you could celebrate the beauty that came from it, but you could also celebrate the distortions, if you will, of modern art, because these were human beings who looked at the world and saw that it was really screwed up. And there's much more truth, I think Schaefer would say, I don't remember him saying this, in some of modern art than there is some of the soupy, quote, Christian art that you see. That sort of plasters over things. They may be pretty, but they're too pretty. Whereas if you look at modern art, you see people who look at the world and say there's something wrong here. It's like one of the treats that everyone remembered back in those days was Priscilla Sandres playing Pink Floyd's album The Wall, and people would gather in their house. I think it was Zeno for dinner, and we would then all sat around on the floor, on steps and whatnot, and listen to Pink Floyd's album The Wall, and it just starts off and it's dramatic. And one of the scenes, which is in, I think, the Hollywood Bowl rendition of this, which was early on, was they built a wall around the band. And there's this plaintive voice that comes out. Is there anybody out there? And so the band is building this wall between them and the rest of reality. But the saddest thing is, and that playing of it, is there's a line, is there anybody in here? So Priscilla saw The Wall by Pink Floyd as telling the truth about reality, that it's broken, it's a mess, and it's really sad. And then, of course, there's the answer. The answer is the Lord Jesus Christ and his love for you.
Scriptures. We have Schaefer's Bible here.
Yes, we do.
And there are so many notes in it. Someone once told me that Schaefer had said, if you want to know what I believe, read my Bible.
Okay.
And I think that's quite true. So from your experience with Schaefer and conversation with him, how would he have viewed the scriptures?
Schaefer viewed the scriptures as the verbal, inspired, plenary revelation of God. That is, it's verbal means it is in words, and that it is inspired by God, and it is the full revelation of God. Those were words that I picked, a verbal, plenary, inspirational, inspired book of God. He was fierce in his defense of the Bible as the Bible. The Bible was God's full and complete, every word inspired by the Holy Spirit revelation to man, and it ultimately ruled everything Schaefer did. He wrote about it, he talked about it, he gave brilliant talks about it. He is there and he is not silent, which is a defense, a book that is a defense of the scripture. I think those were the W.H. Griffith Thomas lectures at Dallas Seminary way back in the late 60s and maybe early 70s, where he made this trenchant defense, not only that God is there, but God has spoken, and not only has he spoken, but contrary to modern neo-orthodoxy and other things of that sort, it wasn't that the Bible contained the Word of God. That's what the verbal plenary stuff means. It was in words, and it was full, and it was God's revelation. It wasn't that you went there to sort of find God's Word. It actually was were the words of God.
So Schaefer read, because I believe he was on this Chicago Council on Inerrancy, if I'm not mistaken, or he served on that council. But from
I'm not sure. He certainly would have agreed with what they did.
Yes, I think,
I don't know. I just don't know whether he was on it or not. I'm sure you're right.
I think he was there, but I'm interested as I look at Schaefer's notes in the Bible, in his Bible. It seems to me that Schaefer must have spent a considerable amount of time, even maybe on a daily basis, in the Scriptures.
Oh, I'm quite certain that he did. He certainly believed in careful reading of the Bible. He was such an honest man who searched out things. And of course, Schaefer, the Schaefer that we know today was formed in disputes in the denomination in which he was back in the middle and late 40s. And he felt that these people were ugly. And he, at one point, he was thrown out. And he wandered wandered around the Swiss countryside trying to decide whether Christianity was true or not, and told Edith at one point, he said that, If I decided it wasn't true, I was going to go home and sell shoes. Mm-hmm. Thankfully for all of us, he concluded that Scriptures were the Word of God. And this little book, like I mentioned, he is there and he is not silent, is a result of that. Now, the result of the musings as he wandered around are more or less contained in True Spirituality, which is just a spectacular book. Mm-hmm. It reveals the heart of what Francis Schaefer was really like. The intellectual things for which too many people looked at and said, oh, well, that's just intellectual things. They don't really matter. Schaefer did those things because he loved people. And he thought that the Bible spoke to all of those questions. And so it was his effort to answer questions that people thought. I'm not sure Schaefer set out to become known as an intellectual. People came to him and asked questions that were intellectual questions. And because he loved them, he tried to answer them. That was my experience. You know, questions I asked him the day before we left. He said, "Is Christianity probably true?" And that question would be offensive to any number of Christians. And he said, "Well, it's so classic." He said, "Well, it depends what you mean." And that was an odd expression he used. Depends what you mean. He said he was sitting on the couch in our living room there, and he said, "If you mean that, I never had any doubts whatsoever." He said, "I do." He said, "But if you mean that I believe Christianity is as true as the table sitting here in front of me, then I believe Christianity is completely true." And that was refreshing because most of the people I'd been around didn't talk like that. They wouldn't confess that they thought about things. But Schaefer clearly thought about things, and he was just fiercely devoted to the truth of the Bible, and he was fiercely devoted to what he called, in his funny way, true truth. Mm-hmm. That Christianity wasn't true to me. Christianity was actually true, full stop, end of discussion. It was true truth.
He was apparently had been influenced by Michael Polanyi.
Yes.
He speaks about, I think it's in... maybe it's in his book on He Is There and He Is Not Silent. But he realized that Polanyi had this maybe what we'd call a critical realist approach, but felt he didn't have any foundation. But he did appreciate this idea that we don't always get it right and that we need to go back and keep examining it.
And that is the reason. The reason we have to do that is because we are broken.
Yes.
And we make mistakes. And so Schaefer was willing to admit that he might be mistaken about this. And someone, I remember asking him at one point, says, "Has all of this reading that you've done affected you?" And the person meant negatively. And Schaefer said, "Well, yes, of course." Because he had immersed himself so that he could serve other people, but he had immersed himself, and he was over. He knew that it had had a negative effect on him. But he knew what these people thought. And there was a meeting with Cornelius Van Til. And, of course, most people view them as opponents. And to a certain extent, they did have differing views. Mm-hmm. But Van Til said, Schaefer's recounting said that, he said in a letter, actually, apparently, you probably have the letter, Van Til says, you, speaking to Schaefer, had talked to 20th century artists and poets and thinkers and singers and actors and dancers and philosophers. And he said, me? I'm only an old bookworm. Well, when I read that, I thought, yes, that's the difference. Now, I'm not here to disparage Cornelius Van Til,
right?
But they had radically, while they believed more or less the same thing, they had radically different approaches to get to it. And there was an attempt made to reconcile Schaefer and Cornelius Van Til somewhere, probably at Westminster Seminary. And they got together, and Schaefer said, "This is wonderful. I wish every worker at Labrie could have heard what you just said." So he was willing to consider what anybody thought.
Mm-hmm. I remember at one time doing a paper for some graduate work comparing Schaefer with, now the name escapes me, he was the apologist that went out to Fuller. My goodness, I should have not brought that up if I couldn't remember the name. But there were two... the apologist that went to Fuller, when Fuller started, mm-hmm. he was brilliant. There was no doubt about it. But he had the intellectual, and it was right. I mean, he was spot yep. on. It was nothing wrong. But I would ask students, Cornell. I would ask students, how many of you ever heard of Cornell? And no hand goes up, right? And how many heard about Schaefer? And all these hands go up. Well, that's because of the different kind of ministry. Both men had the truth and said something to us. But Schaefer just has this profound influence, it seems. And I'm not sure I know how to explain it other than God.
Well, it goes back to his love for people, his sadness. If you on Sunday morning after he preached, he'd go to the back door of the chapel or the church, wherever he was, and he would receive the people, you know, who were there, just like almost everybody does after a sermon. But if you told Schaefer a sad story, Schaefer would just stand there and cry with you. Not only would he pray at the drop of a hat, but he'd cry at the drop of a hat because he was so struck with the saddened condition of the way people were. He was once tricked into a debate. He didn't like the debate because he said, in a debate, you have to win. Mm. He liked to talk to people, but he didn't like debates, and he was tricked into a debate with Bishop Pike, Jim Pike. And after it was over, Jim Pike, and this was shortly before he wandered off in the desert and never came back, Schaefer said that he walked over after the debate was over and shook his hand and said, no one has ever triggered me this well before.
Hmm. We have that taping of that.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've never heard it. I've just heard about it.
Mm-hmm. It's an old reel-to-reel tape. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming at some point here we'll get it digitized. It may already be digitized. I'm not sure. But that debate, or whatever we call it, comes up on several occasions as I speak with people. And
yes.
And the very thing that you're saying is that what other people are saying, that Pike was just rather overwhelmed by the way he had been treated.
Mm-hmm. Now, he came to visit Schaefer, as you probably know.
No, I didn't.
Shortly before he died, and they had tea at their home in Switzerland. So he obviously was dramatically influenced by what, affected anyway, by what Schaefer had, the way Schaefer had treated him.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, maybe we've covered this a little bit, but maybe you want to expand on it. Let's talk about Schaefer in the 21st century. What does he have to say to us? I mean, we're a... you know, I was just reading something on McLuhan, who was, you know, the media ecology. And somebody in this book was saying, well, he wrote in the 20th century for the 21st century.
Right.
And I wonder if Schaefer is not of that same caliber.
I think so. I owned a Christian bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, for my wife and I operated, owned it together for 12 years. I can't remember exactly how long. And I used to tell people that I thought if the Lord didn't return for 500 years, that the books that would be remaining would be Knowing God by J.I. Packer, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and True Spirituality by Francis Schaeffer. Because I thought those books were his timeless God. I was a rare privilege. I went to a LaBrie conference at Covenant College in March of 75, and it was the second or third time that Schaeffer had delivered the talk from the Lausanne conference on evangelism called Two Contents and Two Realities. I remember leaning over to Jane and saying, I've never heard anything like this before. What Schaeffer did in that talk, and I think it's one of the most important ones he gave, was he anticipated entirely the movement that came to be called the emerging church or the emergent church, which are two different strands, but they're related. And what Schaeffer was emphasizing was that evangelicalism in 1975 and before lacked what these people cried for that led to the emerging church. The emerging church was authenticity. They wanted people who were real. And Schaeffer deals directly with that without ever having heard the words emerging or emergent church or any of the people who were involved. It was one of the most prophetic addresses and profound things I've ever heard, because he's laying out, if you will, I don't want to use the word program. He hated that word. Hmm. It was an approach, if you will, to the way things were, that we had to have content of the Bible. We had to have the content of what we believe, but it had to be lived out, and it had to be lived out authentically. My son operates three halfway houses for alcoholics, or however you want to look, former alcoholics, in rural Tennessee. He buys, or I buy for him, True Spirituality by the dozens, and he uses that and to teach the men who come there what Schaeffer had to say in True Spirituality. I think True Spirituality is one of the timeless books of our times. So I think in that book in particular, Schaeffer addresses the issues of modern man, but whatever modern man may be, I think that Schaeffer's message there. But his basic approach to people and his basic approach to reality is something that will fit any time. Schaeffer's book sales are not as strong as they used to be, but you know, his books continue to sell quite well. I think it is too bad that we don't emphasize that Schaeffer doesn't receive even more attention than he does. I'm really grateful for what you have done there by preserving all those things. And my son, Tim, who's working on a PhD in dealing with Schaeffer, was greatly helped by coming down and visiting the archives that you have there about Schaeffer. So there's one person, two of my sons, who are dramatically affected in radically different ways about Schaeffer. Steve is using True Spirituality with people who have ruined their lives with alcohol, and Tim is doing so in an academic setting. So I don't, you know, people, it's hard to sell books often by authors who aren't there. There's a young woman on the other side of the wall here in my office who with her husband are doing a study of books by dead Christians. Mm. And they've used two of Schaeffer's books to do so. So here at Church of the Redeemer in Dunwoody, Georgia, Schaeffer is alive and well, if you will, in his books, and also in halfway houses in rural Tennessee.
Well, that's is important that we have people who will keep these books before the reading public. I think that when it comes to somebody like C.S. Lewis, had it not been for the work of the individual that actually began to work on get his things published, you know, I bring up names again, and I keep Walter Hooper.
Walter Hooper, yes, Father Walter.
Walter Hooper has just played just an indispensable role in keeping Lewis's books on the market and getting manuscripts published. He's worked tirelessly on that, devoted his life to it, in fact. And
he's a delight to be around.
Yes, he is.
Sparkling personality and wit.
Mm-hmm. And
once we were with him after I was the coordinator in National Honor of the Schaefer Films, which was in the C.S. Lewis Films, and we went to after his presentation, we're sitting around and he proposed a toast to the Queen. Now, mm-hmm. Father Wolf, of course, has lived most of his adult life in England, but he's of course from Kentucky.
Yeah.
And he proposed a toast to the Queen, whereupon my wife proposed a toast to Prince Philip.
I not to correct you, but I think he was from North Carolina. He taught.
Oh, it could be.
He taught at Kentucky. But
no, I think you're right.
He was right. Actually, he grew up here in Danville, North mm-hmm. Carolina. But there won't be probably one person who does all of this, but in the sense of what we're trying to do here by preserving all of this material, that we hope to continue to make it known, let people know what is here, how important it is, and try to encourage some sort of new appetite, as it were, for what Schaefer has to say, because I believe it is as important for the 21st century as it was for the 20th century.
But, I can quote two books by other authors that show a profound influence by Schaefer, and his name doesn't come up. I have a friend in Pennsylvania who had a handicapped child, and she wrote a book called "Same Boat, Same Lake, Different Boat," and in that she talks about the effect of the fall upon her son, who was born with a handicapping condition, mm-hmm. and Stephanie Hubach is her name, and it's very clear that she has followed Schaefer carefully, and she's in charge. I'm a member of the Peace President Church in America, and she leads our special needs ministry for the whole denomination. And here is a person who has basically been trained, if you will, by Schaefer. I don't know that Stephanie ever saw him. And it's fairly dramatic. And then another woman whose books are popular right now, Rosaria Butterfield. She's written at least two books, both of which are really worth reading. And the man who led her to the Lord, if you will, a Presbyterian minister of some denomination, it couldn't have been more Schaeferian than Schaefer in his approach to Rosaria Butterfield and in the way he was non-threatening. He didn't come in and said, well, you need this first meeting, you have to repent of your sins and that sort of thing. He very carefully led her to the Lord by answering her questions and posing questions. Very much of a Schaefer approach. So here you have two fairly influential women writing in our time who never, as far as I know, used the words Francis Schaefer. But if you read the books, you see Francis Schaefer all over.
I was not introduced to Schaefer until 1979, maybe 1980. Mm-hmm. So I was introduced to Schaefer by in the academic setting, and mm-hmm. we had read The God Who Is There. Mm-hmm. And then, just maybe a little bit later than that, I read The Tapestry.
Yes.
And I found that is what captured my imagination and began to develop my interest, but even if I should say, even my love for what this man had to say. Having grown up it's not a criticism, but just a statement of fact, when I came to Christ at 20, I came to Christ into a Christian community that was mm-hmm. legalistic. Now they love Christ, but I mean, later as time would go on, Marvin, I would say, you know, I don't think this is the way, the true path to spirituality, even though they were wonderful people.
Yeah, but and people like one of the things that Schaefer mentioned about people like that, although he said that you need to understand that these people are this way because they think it's good for you,
mm-hmm.
and so you mustn't be angry about it.
Mm. Well, when I thought about this, what triggered an emotional response in me was when Schaefer said, in essence, we do not have to commit intellectual suicide to become a Christian.
Yes.
And that simply was, it was like I was saved all over again.
Yes, indeed. I had a similar experience with Schaefer. All of a sudden, the world made sense. Mm-hmm.
As we think about Schaefer in the 20th century, 21st century, what do you think about the intellectual climate, let's say, of the Western civilizations that is such that would cause the Schaefer approach, pre-evangelism, to increase our effectiveness in the presentation of the gospel? Now, when I say effectiveness, I'm not thinking pragmatic terms. I'm thinking in terms of being faithful to our calling.
Yes. I think I said a couple of minutes ago, Schaefer, I think Schaefer's approach is timeless. I think Schaefer would adjust with the times as they flowed. We live in a sad time, a civilization just almost ripped out of Romans 1. For, you know, professing to be wise, they became fools, for they abandoned, you know, the glory of the incorruptible God for all sorts of thought forms and whatnot. I think Schaefer would be as effective today as ever. I don't see a lot of people emulating that. At all, and it's a sad sort of thing. Too many churches have become programmatic. That's one of the reasons that I liked the Rosaria Butterfield book so much. And the story of her first book was the story of how, in the 21st century, this Presbyterian minister treated her well, served her coffee, invited her over to their home, and he and his wife. Entertained her, but there was no high pressure thing. They saw her as a friend in the neighborhood, and they treated her well. And I think Schaefer's approach to things of treating people well, being prepared to answer their questions, and being able to challenge carefully and softly and in a non-threatening way is what made Schaefer who Schaefer is. He gave stirring addresses, but when he was talking to people one-to-one, he was very quiet. He was very understanding. There was a man who came to see him once somewhere in Latin America. I've forgotten. And he said, tell me why I feel significant. Tell me why I'm significant. And don't tell me it's because I'm a Christian. And Schaefer explained this thing that you and I were talking about a few minutes ago, that he was created in the image of God, and he was a creature of great worth. And I don't think that sort of thing ever changes. His approach to the book of Romans, which is one of everybody's favorite things to listen to at Liberty, he says that this sounds as if Paul were answering questions. And so you know, he says, and that's, you pick up that theme in the book of Romans, you pick up that theme in Corinthians, and that's the way Schaefer practiced it. He would answer questions that people ask. I don't think that ever goes out of style, if you will.
Right.
I think it's the way loving people. He got into intellectual things because people wanted to know why did his star, if you will, rise so high? It's because nobody else was doing it, and he was doing it not because he was intellectually curious. He had a fine mind. He read widely. But the main thing you wanted to do, he considered your questions. And that was like if modern people came to him and poured out their souls. We live in such a sad, sad time. Whatever side of the divides, the many divides you have in our society today, people are desperate, I think, for reality. And they're just not finding it. And so they're just getting frustrated. And I'm sorry if I'm stepping on someone's toes, but the current presidential election, I think, is just a case in point. I think Schaefer would have known how to deal with this. Mm-hmm. He would have answered questions quietly, and he would have raised issues because he loved people, because they were created in the image of God, and he wanted them to know that there was salvation in Jesus, and that you could know about these things because the Bible was true. He loved people.
Well, speaking of current state of affairs, politics, his book, The Christian Manifesto.
Yes.
What would you make of that? In the book, it seems like he suggests, to the point that Christians might even take up arms against their government.
Well, I wrote a paper in graduate school on that book. That doesn't mean I'm an expert. That was a long time ago at this point. The effect that what I got from the book was that Schaefer was saying there may come a time at which society will have reached such a state that resistance will be necessary and have to be done. And the Christianity itself, I think, is a resistance to the current world. And I don't mean our current world. I mean whatever current world you happen to be in, it is a resistance to it. But Schaefer followed, Calvin fairly carefully at that point, or maybe they'd come to the same conclusion. I don't know whether Schaefer followed him or not. Well, he did in certainness. But it was that violence, it should always be the last resort. But I remember him saying that if communist tanks were coming up the mountain, they lived about halfway up the top of the mountain, he thought communism was so evil and would ruin his children, would kill them and try to stamp out Christianity, that he would shoot at them.
Well,
he won't do so. Now, he was no anarchist.
Right.
Schaefer never did anything like that. He led a lot of protest marches about abortion, but he never encouraged people to go up and bomb abortion clinics, for example. Yeah, I think he would have been horrified at that.
Yes. I heard him at a conference maybe 3 weeks before he died.
Mm.
And a young man asked him that question, should Christians take up arms? Now, this would have been in 84. Should Christians take up arms? And I was struck by Schaefer's response to that. He said that in the matter of taking up arms, he thought it would be a matter of Christian conscience, that he would not judge one for doing it or one for refraining from it. But that was something he would have, that, you know, the actual act of taking up arms, that he would leave that to Christian conscience. And I felt such a gentleman way of responding, and biblical way of maybe responding to that sort of a question.
We live in a broken world, and a world that appears to me to be careening ever more out of control. And there may be occasions. I'm not a member of the NRA, and I don't go around. I think there probably is something, and you may cut me off. And I say there is probably something to control the weapons. I just don't think people need machine guns. But having said that, I do think that there may come a time that if someone is breaking into my house at night, I will not feel restrained from taking violent action against them. If that means that a large body of people are doing it, would I be willing to take up arms against them? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. But it's always, that sort of thing is with tears, because you will be killing people, as Udo Mendel once said, terminating their biological existence. And that's a very sad, sobering thing to contemplate. But there's almost no one other than radical pacifists who don't have a place where they would use violence against it. Does violence solve anything? Well, violence began to solve the racial issue in the United States in the American Civil War. Is war something that we should be for? No, I think war is something that we should stand against. But is there a place where eventually Christian conscience will demand that you take up arms against someone? I think the answer to that is we all have a spot. It varies, and that may be what Schaefer was getting at. It varies as to where that spot will be. I know I was an officer in the Air Force. I had no qualms about it. I didn't see combat, but I would have if I'd been ordered to do so.
Well, we must realize, I think Schaefer did, and that there are no perfect solutions in this time. And there are always trade-offs. We don't like that, but we don't have any choice.
Yes.
And Schaefer, as you know, would say, if you want perfection or nothing, you'll get nothing every time.
That's right.
So one last question.
Surely.
I was struck a little bit when reading 25 Bible studies and then some other things that Schaefer seemed to be pre-trib and pre-millennial in his eschatology, which would seem, I mean, from what I have known of most in the Presbyterian community, that would have been a break eschatologically. And what would be your response there?
Well, I'm a minister in the Presbyterian Church in America, and I am convinced that neither the Bible nor the confession takes the Westminster Confession, is what I mean, of course, takes the position at that point. How are things going to pan out? One of the things that R.C. Sproul says as well is that is the dispensationalists who were the carrying body of dispensational premillennialism, premill and pre-trib, they preserve tenaciously a belief in the Bible. I'm the kind who says that, you know, I'm a pan-millennialist. It's all going to pan out in the end, or a pro-millennialist. I'm for it. Schaefer was decidedly pre-mill and pre-trib. As I recall, some of the early people in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, the first incarnation of that, eventually became the RPCES, that many of those men were pre-mill and pre-trib. You're quite right, within Presbyterianism today, there are very few people who are premillennial, pre-tribulational, and premillennial. I'm inclined to think that Schaefer has a lot to say about it. He has 40 hours of lectures on it that you can listen to. It would just be a position. Someone asked me once about Schaefer's views on education and what were his views on the millennium, and I knew where the question was supposed to go, that you really couldn't have correct views unless you were post or amill, depending on what the particular person. I basically said it didn't really matter that Schaefer's views on the millennium didn't affect the way he saw the world. He believed that there would come a time at which the church would be removed dramatically, and that the world would go to hell in a handbasket because all godly influence would be removed, and this would be terminated 7 years later by the return of Christ to receive his church and to rule forever. I think that somehow or another that Christ is going to return and he will rule over the world forever and ever. Will it be after a millennium, before a millennium? The main thing in my way of thinking, and I think the main thing in Schaefer's way of thinking, is that the fact that Jesus is going to is redeeming his people, and he will return and will reign forever and ever, as Messiah said, is the main thing, and I think it's the main thing that drove Schaefer. I didn't see, and I lived next door to him for a year, I didn't see his thought particularly shaped by what he thought the Bible taught about end times. And, of course, if you go back and look at the first century, they didn't recognize Jesus when he came the first time, and so our schemes may not be right this time either. I taught in a church once years ago, and someone came up and said, "Well, the notes in my Bible say this is the second return of Christ or something." And I said, "Well, you know, I really don't care. What I care about is the fact that he is going to return." And I think that's what meant most to Schaefer.
Yes. Well, Marvin, thank you so much for this conversation.